If I asked you to think of famous images from the civil rights movement, we would all likely gravitate to the same ones. Black and white snapshots of teenagers at the Woolworths counter, Ruby Bridges walking into school, freedom riders getting on and off their buses, lines of black comrades standing arm in arm in protest. Look closer, though, and the images are simmering with violence. The teenagers at the Woolworths counter dumped on their heads as rageful white townspeople lean in close to those quietly sitting. Ruby Bridges is flanked by police, escorting her to school so that the hordes of snarling segregationists might be prevented from tearing her apart. Smoke billowing from the Freedom Riders bus, a bomb launched through the window. The lines of black faces in protest on the receiving end of a German Shepherd. Fire hoses turned on helpless crowds who did nothing more than gather to chant, to sing, to march in protest. Without these images, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative has said, no one would be prepared to believe the violence we've witnessed. That doesn't refer to me. This is why these images were so powerful at the time, played on major news networks and printed above the fold on the front pages of the paper. The images force a confrontation between the white viewer and their ego. Where do they see themselves in these pictures? Who are they in this struggle? The purpose of nonviolent resistance is, in the words of Dr. King, develop a sense of shame in the opponent, and thereby bring about a transformation and a change of heart. The tactic of inviting violence upon the nonviolent is meant to reveal the absurdity, the depravity, the irrationality of reacting with brutality to peacefulness. It only works if the opponent is prepared to believe violence is wrong, if they are prepared to be transformed. Make no mistake, I believe the civil rights era is far from over. The movement for black lives has punctured any illusions that justice prevailed and King's dream was realized. But in the rooms where strategy is currently hatched, where grand plans to confront white supremacy are debated, I don't think King's strategy holds much sway. When I hear about the ways that white people in the 50s and 60s were gobsmacked to see images of dogs sicked on children, of women dragged from their seats, men clubbed in broad daylight for doing nothing more than sitting at a counter, I don't think that happens anymore. I don't think we have the capacity to be shocked by brutality anymore. Our way of life has become too inundated with violence. We eat it. We eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We are so stuffed with violence, so saturated with television shows that depict women being raped, news stories of children being gunned down at school, video games that make a sport of the field of war. We don't find it alarming anymore to watch a man bleed to death in the backseat of his car after a routine traffic stop, his daughter in the backseat. We aren't prepared to see violence as wrong. We aren't prepared to be ashamed and then transformed. So I say, let us get to preparing ourselves. This is an endeavor worthy of the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, preparing ourselves for a change of heart, preparing ourselves for transformation. What would it look like to lose our appetite for violence? Might we eliminate turns of phrase that suggest killing two birds with one stone or rolling with the punches? Might we rush a child who has turned their stick into a gun on the playground? Might it mean switching the channel when SVU comes on or taking a pass when your friends are gathering to watch the prize fight? Would each of these small things tiny incremental actions prepare us to see with fresh eyes, fresh ears, and renewed hearts the ways in which our world makes violence normal, makes common brutality commonplace. We must be willing to go on a violence diet to reset baseline, curb our appetite. Just as one avoids going to Wendy's, one must avoid situations that invite temptation. We must make provisions in this world to insulate ourselves from the barrage of casual violence, to preserve our indignation, to prepare ourselves for transformation. We must take steps to see violence not as banal, not as commonplace, but as evidence of evil in this world, evidence of that which our faith calls us to reject and resist. We must be prepared to believe the violence we are witnessing is really and truly wrong, so that when a young black man bleeds out in his car, a bullet wound to the belly after a routine traffic stop, his daughter in the back seat, when we see this, we are prepared for our hearts to be broken and then transformed. The images of nonviolent resistance in the civil rights era forced a confrontation between the white viewer and their ego. Who are they in this struggle? I put to you today the images of violence that surround us. They have forced a similar confrontation. Who are you in this struggle? Are you prepared to be aghast, or is your appetite insatiable? White people to the front, to the front. It was being screamed out by a voice nearly hoarse with exertion, three young black women combing their way through the crowds. White people to the front, white people to the front. It was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, November 2014. The grand jury in Missouri had just decided not to indict Darren Wilson in the murder of Michael Brown. Nearly 2,000 people marched to Boston's South Bay Correctional Facility, right near the ramp to I-93. I was one of them. And I was riled. The adrenaline rush was real, and I was so angry, I tell you, I felt rage. Rage unlike I had ever felt before. It made the hair on my arms stand up. It made my ears ring. I could feel my pulse in my temples. The intensity of the moment, the emotional charge in the air, it imprinted on me. I can get myself there if I try. If I close my eyes, I can get there. We had marched from Dudley Square in Roxbury to outside the prison as the crowd grew. We chanted to those inside the cells, "We see you," as some of the inmates held up pieces of paper to the windows with Mike Brown's name on them, and signs scrawled with Black Lives Matter. We were at a standstill. We couldn't go any further without walking into traffic. White people to the front! White people to the front! I turned to my two best friends, one black, one white. We had marched together up until now. We had an inkling this was coming. Miriam said it was up to us if we wanted to split. Virginia said she wasn't sure. I felt, if not me, then who? We kind of knew what was about to be asked of us because at the front, along the very edge of the line, stood the cavalry. There was a long, uninterrupted line of police officers, some in riot gear, interspersed with their motorcycles, creating a barrier between the crowd and the ramp to 93. And so I went. I felt courageous, and I felt scared, but I also truly did feel, if not me, then who? I called my dad as I wended my way up towards the border where police met protest. "Dad, keep your phone near you. I might get arrested tonight." Dad was in bed, sleepy. "Okay, be careful, honey. Love you." So the plan started to circulate among the crowd. we were going to march onto the I-93 ramp. We were going to shut down traffic. And we were being asked to put our bodies between the police and protesters of color. And when I got to the edge, the very place where police met protest, I looked out at all the lights, and I looked down the line at all the white faces who had joined me at the front. The police officer who stood before me, he must have been 6'2", 6'3". He wore a helmet with the visor up. In my mind's eye, he was wearing sunglasses, but that doesn't make sense because it was nighttime. But he was a statey. Massachusetts State Police dress like the SS. It's a known fact that their uniforms are modeled after them. Gray, blue, button-up shirt with gold detailing, tall leather boots. It is an imposing figure. And it was then that I felt fear. I had come to the front full of piss and vinegar, full of rage and adrenaline, and I faced the policeman in front of me, and in a moment when I wanted to be brave, I demurred. I made small talk. He talked to me like I was a silly girl. "We're here for your protection. These drivers, they don't care about you marching for some protest. We're trying to keep you safe, you know? And I hope you all know me well enough at this point to know I don't take kindly to being treated like a silly girl." On any other day, he'd have another thing coming. But instead, I played nice. I said, No, I know, officer, I know. It's true, I'm from here. I'm a Massachusetts driver. Because this is what happens when you come face to face with the power of state violence. When you confront the behemoth, that is the police, I quaked and I crumbled and I felt myself defer to my passive, accommodating self, the sweeter, more conciliatory self, because I was scared. And even in my heart, though I loathed what he stood for, what he symbolized, what he could get away with against my body and especially the bodies of black and brown people, I couldn't spit on him. I couldn't goad him. I couldn't taunt him. But I definitely couldn't just ignore him. I wanted to be stronger in my protest. I wanted to be more determined, and yet I was crushed with intimidation. The takeaway here is not there's a person on the other side of that uniform, or if we all just listened and spoke kindly, we could work it out. I tell this story because we are rarely in front of the monster. We are rarely face to face with the powers that be, and even the bravest and most self-righteous among us fold. Because the power is real, the power is violent, and it is intimidating. I came to the front of that protest because I believed, if not me, then who? I came to the front of that protest because my sisters in the struggle had asked me to. I came to the front to confront unchecked state violence, to speak truth to power, and I intended not to be silenced. That was what I intended to do. But instead, I folded. Instead, I stood at the front, making small talk with the statey, trying to reclaim my resolve to break through, awaiting instruction for what our next move would be. When we talk about what it means to face down our enemies, to confront systems of injustice, and to remain upright with dignity, to resist fighting back, to submerge our fear, this is no small task. The civil rights movement, the nonviolence preached by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, it is not a task for the faint of heart. To be pressed up against the power and to ignore the waves of antagonism crashing into you, to remain calm, this is not passive. This is not timid. This is hardcore. I wasn't up to it. I was defeated that night, both in my exchange of pleasantries with the cop and also in the way I wandered away from the front lines after a couple of hours standing around. We don't always contain the courage we need. We don't always have what the moment demands. But there will be more moments. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I was blessed in my meekness that night, as we all are in times when our courage fails us. But the Gospel of Matthew reminds us too, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. May we find the fortitude for righteousness. May we expect persecution in exchange for pursuing justice, knowing ours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed be, and amen. White people to the front. I was surprised when Kim offered me MLK Sunday. I was surprised and honored and excited. It felt like all my years of training had been leading to this moment to give you a good word on the Reverend Doctor. Quickly, though, I moved through my giddiness and arrived at something closer to fear. A lot of fear coming up today. And I have been plagued by this fear for the last few months at the thought of what I would say as it began to swirl and stew, and I prayed that those swirling thoughts would coalesce into something concrete, something tangible that I could put down on the paper. I really wanted to blow everyone's hair back today. I really wanted to write a sermon that would get you out of your seats, that would invigorate you, that would thrill you, would inspire you. I hoped that MLK Day would be a chance to prove myself as a righteous and prophetic voice in the fight against white supremacy. But every time I sat down to write, to put words to paper, I arrived at a dead end. This holiday has been observed for 32 years, and each time I thought I had something inspiring to say, I was sure you had already heard it. Kim's past sermons proved that. I didn't want to heap too much praise on the man, making him one-dimensional and saccharine. He wasn't a god. He had flaws. He had faults. But if I criticized too much, if I parsed too much out, I'd potentially lose the possibility to move any of you closer to a vision of racial justice that honors his vision. And not for nothing, but I'm a white minister. I think we should consider the possibility that there is limited insight into the work of Dr. King from the white perspective. There are just only so many angles from which I can see it. There are only so many ways to dice it up and feed it back to this predominantly white congregation. We arrive at this day leaden with expectations, and I do mean leaden, weighed down, heavy. It's almost perfunctory. We show up today and expect to hear something about the beloved community, to hear a reminder that the work still needs to be done, still exists. We arrive today to get a kick in the pants because we expect to leave motivated and reinvigorated. These expectations, we lay them on a single man on a singular day. We lay them on his grave. We heap them on his grave. But the expectations stifle our ability to see the vivid legacy that lives today. Expectations are the cousin of obligation, and we are not obligated to be here. We are not obligated to do the work our faith calls us to, and we choose it joyfully. We choose this faith, and we honor the legacy of Dr. King by engaging with his work on all the other days of the year. It lives in the counter-protesters from this congregation who showed up in Princeton, in the declaration that these grounds are a peace site, in the Black Lives Matter sign ablaze on the lawn, in the theological tussle in implementing our eighth principle. The spirit of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. endures so vividly because it cannot be confined to a day and it cannot be dampened by decades of expectations. May the word brought today remind you of the work you have done and the work yet to do, and in the name of Dr. King, but also in the name of our collective liberation from violence, from apathy, from fear, and from white supremacy. May it be so, and blessed be.